Great. I've been asked to speak to you this afternoon about common objections to the rationality of faith, or arguments that are typically advanced to show that faith and reason are in conflict with one another. This is a topic or an area I'm familiar with since I studied in graduate school for many, many years with professors who were hardcore atheists and had no difficulty articulating and advancing their arguments. We heard them all the time. So what I'd like to do is articulate some of the most common ones that they gave me, and I'd like to discuss them amongst us. There's a lot of brain power in this room, so if we put our heads together and think about these arguments, we can see through them rather quickly and easily, and various flaws and problems that they have. But they also have a function of setting before us the magnitude of what we're dealing with when we try to advance the gospel or the wisdom of St. Thomas Aquinas or the practice of the Catholic faith in the contemporary university context. Also, I'd like to get kind of everybody a discussion going about whether these are the actual arguments that are still being used or commonly used. I have a feeling that basically where we're at now culturally is the last one, which we'll come to, called the Christianity is evil objection, which isn't really based on reason, or it is, but it's kind of a blend of reason and emotive kind of outbursts or sob stories or various things. So we'll come to that. So let's just put it this way. We'll begin talking as if reason was still in play in the contemporary discourse. So to the extent that things are discussed, rationally discussed, or settled by reason, there's exchanges of reasons. So we'll discuss some of the most common exchanges of reasons, and then at the end we can ask ourselves, maybe reason isn't really playing that kind of role in our society anymore, and then we can talk about that. All right, so these are very common objections that I've laid out in argumentative form here on the handout. We'll go through them, and tomorrow when I give my talk, I'll step back and say, you see, these are actually embedded within a much larger philosophical program or philosophical picture, and we'll try to outline that bigger picture. But let's just start with the arguments as they're normally advanced. So number one, the wishful thinking objection is very common. Just going through it premise by premise, Christian belief is wishful thinking. And number two, wishful thinking is irrational. Why is it wishful thinking? You just want there to be a God and a heaven and an afterlife. Or maybe you just want there to be justice for people you think are doing bad things, you just want there to be these things. It's comforting to you. It's a crutch. It's something that allows you to cope with the difficulties of life. So fill in whatever psychological story you want there about why it's wishful thinking. It's not too hard to elaborate such a story. Wishful thinking is irrational, therefore Christian belief is irrational. Now let's just see this. How many of you have heard this objection from either a professor or fellow students? Okay, yeah, pretty common objection still, okay? What do we say in response to this? Well, what's the definition of wishful thinking? It's believing something because you want it to be true, but without sufficient evidence. Okay? So there's two things that need to go on there. One is you have to believe something that you want to be true. And then there has to be also, second, a lack of sufficient evidence. Now, the second component leads to our next objection, the evidentialist objection, which focuses specifically on that issue, whether there's sufficient evidence to confirm the truth of Christian beliefs. Okay? We'll come to that in a minute. But let's just stick with the part about whether it is wishful thinking or not. Are we just simply believing something that we want to be true? Now, you might be tempted to just jump right to the second one, say there's sufficient evidence, here we go, and then you're on to the next one. But it's actually good to sit with the first part of it for a moment. Are we believing things that we want to be true? Yes, you could say that, like if you understand the testimony as a whole. But if you've ever struggled with any of the doctrines of the faith, you have good reason to give to stay. So hold on a second there. I believe there's a hell, but I don't wish there's one. I wish there weren't, but I believe there is. So we can't say, if we take the whole, yes, it reveals the good life for man, so we're going towards what we want. But if we start to go doctrine by doctrine, there's many difficult teachings that we might not wish were true, but we believe them anyway, okay? So you can actually respond to the objection easily enough and say, look, there's many things I hold that I wish weren't so, but I believe them because God has revealed them, or whatever the case may be, okay? The other thing is, just because someone can make a case or tries to make a case that we believe these things for the sake of comforting ourselves or as a crutch or as a coping mechanism or something like that, psychobabble kind of stories like that, they cut both ways. And it's very easy to turn around and tell the story the other way. There's actually a lot of comforting thoughts in naturalism, okay? If you think of, you just deny that there's a God because you don't want to stand before him in judgment someday. You deny that there's an afterlife just because you don't want to be morally accountable for your actions and receive the punishments that are due. So it's actually a form of self-comforting to deny the existence of God, the judgment tribunal of God, or other such things, okay? So on that score, it seems like atheism is just as much a matter of self-comforting as Christianity would be, or could be. I mean, you could be very easy to go through various things and say you're just comforting yourself. You're telling yourself this story to make yourself feel good, okay? Especially if you have a lifestyle contrary to the Sixth Commandment, okay? You just tell yourself, there's no God and there's no judgment and I can continue to live this way freely. It's very comfortable. You can do all kinds of things sexually that you otherwise wouldn't be able to do. So you could go there if you wanted to. That might be a fight, but you could go there, okay? by the way, just so you realize, this is something else we could talk about. I've lined the objections up so that they're about what? They're about Christian beliefs or they're about Christian faith. But when the arguments are articulated in real life, they're not about Christian belief or about Christian faith. They're about Christians. That means it's about you. Okay? So when you go to respond to the argument, you might be tempted to make it about the other person as well. And then you get the judgment, and then you get the accusation of being judgy. But it's interesting. These are all pretty judgy if you look at it that way. So you can use as well. Okay, in terms of dealing with these things on the ground. But it seems to me the real answer to the wishful thinking objection, even though that what we gave already are some important distinctions and things you could say, the real answer is that, in fact, it's not wishful thinking because there are good reasons to hold Christian beliefs. Now that's where we go to the next objection. But before we go to the next objection, let's just stop. Like I said, I'd like this to be conversational. What do you think about the wishful thinking objection? Any other criticisms or replies that I maybe have overlooked? Let's put our heads together.
Well, I think it also kind of belies a deep cynicism. And there's kind of, I think that like wishful thinking is sort of a pejorative term for hope, I think, in many cases.
Okay.
Like,
yep.
People think that we're too hopeful about our future. That there's too much good that's possible.
Yeah, that's right.
People have a really cynical view, nihilistic view of the world.
I think that
the world is too evil for Christianity to be.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. We're going to get to it tomorrow when we talk about the wisdom of the world as opposed to the perennial philosophy. And the wisdom of the world radically denies our fundamental intuitions and basically tells you, you just have to accept that your deepest, most fundamental intuitions about yourself and about reality are just false. And you just got to accept the pain that comes with that. And that's where I think a lot of people have basically cajoled themselves into accepting that. Contrary to our inclinations and nature. And so there really is a habit of dark view of the world, really a habit of despair, and despair about reason. JP2 talks about that in Fides et Ratio.
I'm wondering about, I guess like one big thing that I tried to think about is like when I was talking specifically about Christianity and when we were talking specifically about like any sort of deism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering here, for the wishful thinking objection,
yep.
I guess would... In considering, for example, a non-Christian believer, or like say like a pagan or anyone else, I feel like I would almost be inclined to use this wishful thinking Argument, yeah. For example, believes in a thunder god, or
right.
some sort of like a pagan god that is like just a nice way of thinking about why certain
right.
phenomena happen. So where is, I guess, like, where is the distinction being, and why is this?
Why does it apply to them,
like,
but not to us? Kind of
right.
thing. Yeah, I think that you need both of the things that I'm giving you, which is there's lots of things we believe that we don't wish to be true. I do think that there's an important that's an important point to make.
Right.
So it's not just wishful thinking. Whereas with other, depending on what the package is that the person believes in, it could be all comforting all the way through and nothing hard. That's why I think a lot of people are drawn to Far Eastern kind of practices, Buddhism, yoga, the New Age kind of thing. There's nothing really difficult in it.
For example, like even like Aztec religion that requires human sacrifice, probably like, you know, I'm assuming that is hard to accept for some people. And I'm sure that they had plenty of reasons why they could show that there is good to have like physical or evidence for.
Right. We'll get into the question of evidence as we go.
Okay.
A lot of it's gonna turn on the question of evidence, yeah.
Why there's like difficult doctrines in Christianity is because like, they were made by powerful leaders in order to subjugate like the lower peoples. Something like
yeah,
that.
We'll come to that later. That's part. It sounds like the Christianity's evil objection, and or a version of it. And the answer to that, I guess, the first thing would be is if it was simply a matter of the powers of the church trying to articulate things to subjugate people, they would not have articulated things. As they did, they would have accepted the heretical options on a lot of doctrinal positions along the way because those are easier for larger numbers of people to swallow. So if they were just trying to corral the masses, they would have gone with a conceptually easier number of options. But instead, they always went with like the really difficult, most mysterious thing as a matter of course. So it's almost like they were intentionally making it hard to believe. Yeah. Well, let's give other people a shot in the back.
I think you take the wishful thinking objection one step further, however, and say that it depends on maybe the cultural context or whatnot, that the difficult doctrines that we still uphold despite the fact that we don't really want to, that
yep.
you say, but you do want to live a very reductive, chaste lifestyle like that.
Yeah.
That provides structure to your life.
Right.
you seek that order and that rigor, and so it's still wishful thinking, even if you deny yourself all this freedom of confidence.
There's a number of things to say in response to that. I guess it sounds like what you're getting at is saying you really have underlying, like your outward empirical kind of manifestations deep down behind the masks, you secretly do want these things to be true. That becomes a question of how do you verify someone's actual wishes and desires? And in an age where the hermeneutic of suspicion is at play as a method of rationality, people have a habit of mind of saying what's presented in the empirical given is not the real story. That needs to be unmasked to find a more sinister motive behind it or an underlying kind of mechanism. So you'd say, that is where you'd have to say, okay, how are we going to verify people's actual beliefs, actual intentions, and actual commitments? And it's not going to be straightforward. You say, look, psychologists have talked about this, and it's hard to find people's actual beliefs and wishes, which actually makes it harder for the wishful thinking objection. And also, people can have internal conflicts. They can both want it and not want it at the same time in different respects. So that complicates things, too.
Yeah, I think in that case, it can be useful to like find an example that's appropriate for like, a personal.
Could you speak up a little so everyone can hear?
Sorry. I think in that case in particular, it can be useful and usually not hard to find some personal example of struggling to come to terms with some doctrine or teaching of the church. Maybe it's not in sexual ethics, for example,
yeah.
but maybe it's just like something that, obviously it's a teaching of the church, but wouldn't really have a huge impact on your day-to-day living, so it's harder to make that change. But I was going to say, I think it is very important and it's very rare to ask people what they actually want to be true, and I found that it's it's really helpful, not because like you're being incredibly combative about it, but sometimes they haven't even thought through that really.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you actually want to be true? And I think in particular, in sort of like the new atheist thinking, people are often dishonest to say like, oh, I'd love for Christianity to be true, but it's just not.
Right.
And I think that's sort of a rhetorical cheap trick, because if you poke it a little bit, like there's no way that Christian traditions, you say that a lot, actually wanted Christianity to be true.
Which goes back to the point we made earlier, how do you verify people's actual beliefs and wishes? So maybe a good way to approach it is through actual dialogue. What do you want to be true? Instead of saying, here's what you really want. I'll tell you what you really want. You know, that kind of approach. Yeah.
So the problem with any objection like this, regardless of where it's coming from, but like specifically with this direction, is it's a conversation stopper. If the goal of the conversation is to evaluate the claims of Christianity and with respect to their truth values, you're not doing that with this objection.
Right.
What you're doing is you're attempting to psychoanalyze the person.
That's right.
None of us have the credentials to do that. Even I have some skepticism if you can truly psychoanalyze.
That's
someone.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can bring out statistics that a large percentage of actual diagnoses done by clinical psychologists in settings with proper testing, a large number of those are false.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of false
diagnoses. Yeah, I don't think it's a good idea to ever like assume what someone's thinking. It's best just to take them at their word and go from there.
Yeah, you can do that, but you raise a really important point. Notice the conclusion, not only of this objection, but the next one, that faith is irrational. And a number of philosophers have pointed out that as soon as you call a position irrational, just that very label has the effect of shutting down discourse, because you're basically saying to the other person, you're not suited for rational discourse with me. So it's the kind of objection that I think it does have that. Because of the very conclusion that we're being argued for against. I mean, imagine if a Christian were to come out and say, this position is irrational. Right? That would be considered very adversarial, confrontational, judgy kind of discourse. But we have it heaped on us, like, on a regular basis. So.
But doesn't that objection also sometimes conflate the idea of beauty and wishful thinking, finding something beautiful? So the idea that the truth is beautiful, which is a normal Christian position, but also in other philosophies. That seems to be something that if wishful thinking is, I desire something to be true, therefore that's why I believe it.
Yep.
But finding something beautiful looks very similar, which,
Right. Well,
I am attracted to. Both of them are certain type of attractions.
Yeah.
And this objection seems to just collapse the types of attractions into wishful thinking. It's like, no, if I see a nice building like the one outside, it's not that I'm wishing it to be
right.
true, it's that I am moving.
That's a good response. In fact, I've never heard that before. So you could ask the interlocutor, how do you distinguish between wishful thinking and beliefs based on beauty? Scientists will often accept the most elegant theory on the basis of its elegance or its beauty, and there's an evidential power that beauty itself is considered to have. So how do you differentiate believing something to be true because it's beautiful versus wishful thinking? That'd be a challenging question. That'd be a good response, I think.
Following up, I think, to wish for something is to desire it.
Yep.
And we're only really moved to investigate something insofar as we desire to know it. And we would never be motivated to investigate something that we don't believe at least could be true or might be true. And so in some sense, every serious inquiry is based on wishful thinking.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you could end up saying science itself, the scientific enterprise, is based upon the belief that the world is intelligible. And there is a kind of skepticism. It says, well, how do you know that, even to begin with? And that's basically just wishful thinking. Now, there's actual metaphysical reasons that can be given for saying that reality is intelligible. But you're right. At the origin of every inquiry is a desire based upon some belief about the way things actually are. Let's move on to the next one. I want to make sure we get through all of them in the time we have. The evidentialist objection. This was probably the most common objection we heard. Alvin Plantinga, the great philosopher and epistemologist, who was at the University of Notre Dame for many years, he basically built his philosophical career largely around answering this objection and doing all the work that needed to be done to answer this objection. he basically points out that only a few philosophers have articulated it premise by premise, but a few have. But really, it's one of those objections that's nonetheless in the air everywhere you turn. Every seminar you take, every conversation, all the conferences you go to, it's always in the atmosphere. It's the, I guess you could say, the underlying objection to the faith. There's two forms of it. One's based on something called the evidentialist principle. It goes like this. Number one, it is irrational to believe something without sufficient evidence. And number two, Christian faith consists of believing many things without sufficient evidence. Therefore, Christian faith is irrational. Now, that version of the argument turns on this concept of sufficient evidence. Okay? And the first thing you might ask yourself is, well, what counts as sufficient? Okay? And we're all familiar with the game. Maybe you've played it. In fact, Jesus seems to have played it with the Pharisees, that they ask for evidence, and he gives a sign. And what do they say? It's not enough. We need more. So he gives another sign, or he gives them more premises. It's not enough. Give me more. And you ratchet it up, and you give more signs, more evidence, more premises. I need more. I need more. I need more. And what you're running up against is a kind of insatiable appetite for signs and evidence. Okay? So what counts as sufficient? That's very difficult to say. Okay? Or to answer a priori. Now, the expression sufficient evidence can be taken out, and you can use a whole variety of other terms. Proof, grounds, warrant, justification, reasons, good reasons, or any such thing. And when you take out the expression sufficient evidence and use one of those others, what you realize is, whoa, this argument is traveling around and masquerading under many, many different guises. Philosophically, it's substantively the same argument. You just don't have sufficient reasons. Now, Aquinas himself was aware of this argument, of course, and he answered it in many different places throughout the Summa. Before I jump to reading some of his texts, I'd like you to jump down to... you see where I have the regardings there? There's different ways you can run this argument. You can run it regarding the existence of God. There's not enough evidence for the existence of God. And there you'd answer the question, and you'd answer it in one way. You could go to natural theology, like we did this morning. Okay? When it comes to the mysteries of faith, like the resurrection, you have a very different way of answering it. Okay? Because you don't want to say that we believe in the resurrection based on evidence and historical considerations. There's a number of problems that come with that, as we'll get to in a minute. Okay? And then you have other issues like the historicity of Scripture and the fact of miracles. So you can get the problem of miracles is essentially this argument applied specifically to miracles. That's basically what Hume's argument regarding miracles is. So there's a very general form of the argument that's just about Christian faith generally. Then there are specific versions of the argument regarding God, regarding particular mysteries like the resurrection, regarding miracles, regarding the historicity of the Bible. There's all kinds of things, okay? Let's go to what Aquinas says in the second part of the second part, question 2, article 9, reply to the third objection. Here's Aquinas's basic answer to this objection. The believer has a sufficient motive for believing. He uses the word motive. See, there's many different terms that could be used. The believer has sufficient motive for believing. For he's moved by the authority of divine teaching. God said so, basically. Okay? He's moved by the authority of divine teaching, confirmed by miracles. That's a very important little clause. Okay? Confirmed by miracles. And what is more, by the inward instigation of the divine invitation. And so he does not believe lightly. In other words, for Aquinas, faith has three features. Number one, it's acceptance of testimony as God's own testimony. It's acceptance of testimony as God's own testimony. Number two, there's confirmatory signs. Now here he says miracles, but I'll just say more broadly, signs. Okay? And in other places, like Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 1, Chapter 6, he gives a whole list of signs, okay? You've got miracles, you've got healings, you've got the fulfillment of prophecies from the Old Testament. You've got the pronouncement of sublime doctrine. You've got the expansion of the church, the miraculous expansion and stability of the church through time. You have the experience of peace and joy that's from another order, a more sublime or supernatural experience of peace and joy, etc. He gives basically a list, and that list is effectively chapter headings for large-scale investigations into the topic of signs. And all down through history, Christians have always gathered and studied and reflected upon signs or confirmatory signs. They're doing taxonomy studies, explanatory kind of patterns. There's inductive versions of the argument, deductive versions of the argument, abductive versions of the argument. It's really the science of what's now called fundamental theology. Okay? It used to be very, very common for Catholics to be educated in that at some point, either in like junior high or in high school. We can find old, you know, religion books from like the 20s, and they would actually give them the signs that confirm the divine origin of the Christian faith. Unfortunately, in the last 50 years or so, the study of signs has become kind of passé. Like, people think, oh, don't bother with all that. People don't believe for that reason, etc. And you got to be careful. Yes, that's not the proper and per se reason for believing, but man, it really does help a lot of people in an auxiliary kind of way, in a secondary way. And it's actually a lot of fun to go through the signs. What are the signs that impress you? Well, what are the signs that impress you? And in a room like this, there'd be a lot of signs we could elaborate and articulate. So, but most importantly, Aquinas says, we have the third factor, which he calls the inward instigation of the Holy Spirit. We don't want to overlook that by any stretch. Aquinas wants us to realize that the proper reason why a person believes in the existence of God is because he's interiorly moved by, and we could say, an instinct, the instinct of the Holy Spirit, that's his language, an instinct of the Holy Spirit, or an instinct of faith, which properly translated, we could really mean like inspiration or inclination or principle of inclination. Your person is moved from within to accept the testimony in a basic way. Okay, so we hold this as first principles in a manner analogous to the first principles of a science. The articles of the creed are analogous to the first principles of a science, he says, which tells us that they're first principles. So what we have is a body of testimony confirmed by signs, which we do not believe because of the signs, but which we believe because we're moved inwardly to accept the whole in a simple way. Okay? Now there's a lot there. I just laid out to you a quick account of the theological virtue of faith and how the ascent of faith works, and it's a very mysterious matter. It's unlike other acts of belief regarding matters that fall within the range of reason. So we can talk about that at length. But I wanted to at least get across the point that we do not believe in the testimony of the apostle, the prophets and the apostles. We do not believe in the mysteries of faith because of the signs that confirm the testimony. Why do we not do that? Aquinas says it many times. Faith does not believe on account of arguments. That's a quote. Faith does not believe on account of arguments. Which is really interesting from a guy who does arguments like all the time, right? That's what he does. He knows how arguments figure into the act of faith, and they're not in the position of being the basis on which we affirm these things, okay? They're in an auxiliary position, okay? They clarify, they explain, they bring out the intelligibility of it, etc., okay? Why does that matter? Let's go to the next version of the evidentialist objection, the proportional form. This you'll find in David Hume and in others who are kind of follow him. Quite common today. Number one, rational beliefs are proportionate to the evidence. Another way to put it would be like this: the degree of confidence with which you hold something ought to be proportionate to the degree of evidence for it. So if something has like a 75% probability, you're degree of confidence, and it ought to be about 75%. Now, how do you assess that? There's game theory, and how much are you willing to bet? And there's different ways that people analyze all of that, okay? But the idea is that the belief should never be, you should never be more subjectively certain about something than there is evidence for it. So you see, you're supposed to have a proportion between belief and evidence. So the principle goes. But Christian beliefs are not proportionate to the evidence. Like, well, the certitude regarding the existence of God or the mysteries of faith or the resurrection of Jesus or things is like absolute. So like historical reasoning could get you at the very best, you could get a probabilistic argument that let's suppose it was 90% probable that Jesus rose from the dead, okay? Based on historical critical reasoning and abductive inference from the text and the data that's available, 90% chance Jesus rose from the dead. Well, then you should have 90% degree of confidence in it. But we have more confidence in it than that. So the beliefs are out of proportion, okay? The answer to that is precisely Aquinas's, he saw this problem. I think he saw it very clearly. And he says, all throughout his writing career, from the earliest writings to the latest, faith does not believe on account of arguments. This is why the idea of the basic belief is so important. These are first principles, basic beliefs, which we believe because of that inward instigation of the Spirit. But it just so happens it's also surrounded by lots of confirmatory signs which allow us to answer objections like this. That's the point, one of the points of the signs, okay? All right. And we can run the proportioning argument regarding the other things as well, the existence of God, mysteries of faith, historicity of Scripture, etc. All right, let's open it up for conversation. What do you think of the evidentialist objection?
The passage from the Summa, you talk about Aquinas' argument against it. I wouldn't find that convincing if I weren't a Christian, because essentially what he's doing is arguing that the basis for our beliefs are the very things that the evidentialist argument is calling into question in the first place.
I see, you see the problem. So he basically says we believe it because God says so. Okay.
And
then the skeptic is always going to come back and say, well, how do you know God says so? But that's why he sees that. That's why the very next clause is confirmed by miracles.
Right.
So he wants...
But a skeptic wouldn't believe in miracles either.
Oh, that's another thing. That would be making the evidentialist argument specifically regarding miracles.
Okay,
further, it's reducing the signs to just miracles alone, which in this passage he kind of does, but in other places he realizes there's a much more expansive list. So it's not just miracles. And furthermore, when he has in mind miracles, he doesn't just mean the miracles in the Bible. He means contemporary ones as well. That's part of his argument as well. So the person who's going to be skeptical about miracles, that just raises the question, well, how do you deal with the problem of miracles? And one way to go with it is we'll argue about the past miracles last. Let's start with contemporary ones. So are you willing to get on a plane, go to Lourdes, and we can like start there. Okay? Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that point that I found that usually I haven't seen
Yeah.
The basic beliefs and
there's good reasons. I mean, that scripture tells us that's one of the confirmatory signs.
Yeah, and it's helpful, but I usually find it kind of withers down in the sense of they're like, yeah, sure, that sounds like a great story. And that you can tell in their heart they're not left.
Sure.
Yeah, I find that I've had a conversation where when you talk about the other signs, it tends to be more effective. And,
right.
Whether or not you can contribute it as well, like a personal example, like I was talking recently with someone who's talking, he's like, how do you pray? Like, what does that actually mean to you to pray? And
yeah.
I talk about like having a dialogue with the Lord in this way in which you sort of question and ponder and receive this sort of mystical or mysterious rather response that's hard to sort of interpret, and found that like really interesting.
Yeah.
So, then you know, when you talk about whether it's the grace that you get out of something like confession or something like that,
sure.
You talk about these elements,
sure.
It's interesting that our society
expressing
a degree of sentiment has returned to we're not doing strictly logical people sometimes. They want a little bit of personal element and they expect you to go to did you know what that was in 1917?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I know that happened 100 years ago and
right.
All the reasons why. Like they can't come up with the reason why the miracle's wrong, but they just don't acknowledge it.
Right.
I feel like you're right, the more you can bring it into a contemporary and even personal testimony, it's usually to talk about the inspiration of the Holy Spirit kind of combined with confirmatory signs in your own life.
Sure. That's a great point. There's a lot of things to say in response. First, we have to distinguish between evangelization strategies, generally speaking, and answering objections in particular, okay? So a lot of times, if we're not careful, we can think, and this is the way the evidentialist objection is set up. It's set up in such a way that there's one interpretation of that. If you refute the objection, then I'll be a Christian. So it's like, but not necessarily. This objection could just be defeated, but the person could have other reasons for not being a Christian. So evangelization strategies are one thing. Answering objections is another. Finding fallacies in an argument is another. So we can find fallacies in the argument. But what the trick is that the second premise says you believe it without sufficient evidence. The one way to respond to the argument is to go right to the second premise and start supplying evidence. And then you think, oh, well, if I just supply enough evidence, then the person will believe, and this is my evangelization strategy. And then what you realize is, wait a second, no, there's more to a conversion than simply premise, conclusion. There's personal factors, there's the will, there's the desire to, you know, there's attrition, there's studies, and Thomists have done the studies of stages of conversion. And arguments are a factor in one of the stages. But they're not by any stretch the whole story of conversion. So you're right to say there's way more to the conversion process than just arguments or reasons or replying to them. That's a moment within the process. And yes, the second point about things being personal, that's an important observation as well. A lot of people fault what they call the old apologetics for appealing to reason alone. Like it, of all the powers of the soul, it speaks to like the intellect, but like forgets the other powers of the soul and like forgets the person, doesn't speak to, it's rhetorically unmoving that way, okay? Like Augustine's much more rhetorically powerful. But there's nothing to prevent Thomists from elaborating a very Augustinian line of reasoning. What you're really looking for is happiness, and here's your inclinations, and here's the answer to your inclinations here in this testimony. Oh, and by the way, this is awesome, or you're drawn to it. Oh, by the way, there's also all these confirmatory signs. But that's just a point off to the side. Okay? So you can do that too. The last thing I'll say is that one of the things that's important for us to realize, actually, I forgot. Let me just, I'll hold off on the third thing for now. Yeah.
The response I want to jump to when I hear this is that secular, agnostic, atheist folks actually don't have knowledge in the way that they think. That the words faith, belief, and knowledge are things that aren't appropriate. So I'm wondering if you could speak more about how these people don't know as much.
Great point. So for a lot of people, faith in our society, when they hear the word faith, it's practically synonymous with feeling, sentiment, opinion, private point of view, and things like that. It's practically synonymous with that. In the ancient world, though, it's clearly understood. I mean, the very nominal definitions of the word meant that faith is accepting something on the word of a witness. So faith is testimonial belief. And once you realize that faith, properly speaking, is testimonial belief, you realize human beings can't live without faith. Augustine has a lot on this, yeah? We can't step outside the matrix of testimony. Everything in our lives is kind of built around testimony from other people. Science itself would grind to a halt if scientists did not take each other at their words when they reported their results. So there's no way to live without faith. That would basically be antisocial personality disorder if you tried to live without faith, without trusting anyone about anything. So there's lots here you can start to say why faith, generally speaking, is reasonable. I mean, Augustine's great examples are like, where were you born? He said, I was born in Michigan. Well, why do you believe that? my mom and dad told me. And then people say, like, no, but I have a birth certificate. That's a form of testimony. what it is. I say, another example he has, how do you know that the man you think is your dad is your dad? There's only one person who knows, your mom. That's it. But then people say, oh no, I could do a DNA test, I could do a DNA test. Can you read DNA tests? otherwise, you have to believe the expert who tells you this is the right DNA. So there's really no way out of the testimonial matrix. So, I mean, the question becomes, is it reasonable to believe the apostles? Is it reasonable to believe the apostles when they say they've been divinely inspired and they're telling you God's own word? That's where the argument goes. Classically, traditionally speaking. Yeah.
My response generally when I get one of the prove God exists is to say prove that he doesn't. And then they abruptly will switch to another. They're like, oh, well, because why is there evil in the world? They automatically will switch away from that one and go to the
problem. That's right. So the problem of evil is always on the list. We'll get to that later. I would just watch out for burden of proof kind of debates. There's all kinds of considerations. And I never found those very fruitful. Who's the burden of proof really on, the believer or the person who doesn't believe? I just say let everyone come forward with their arguments for their position.
As far as proportionate for belief, whether the evidence is proportionate for belief, I've had this discussion a couple of times, and I found even a non-believer to be perceptive of mm-hmm. this distinction, mm-hmm. that evidence can be proportionate to lead you to the judgment that you ought to believe, and this is something you ought to do.
Yeah.
But then that you need God's help to then say, I do believe.
That's very interesting. That's exactly the theological reasoning. And there's also stories down through history of people who have gone to Lourdes. They've seen miracle happen right before their very eyes. And they'll say, I want to believe, and I see that I should believe, but I just can't. There's been actual people in those circumstances, yeah.
Yeah, I think something that is related to this proportionality idea seems to have been in vogue now is this idea of parsimony. So it's sort of a scientific principle.
Yeah.
How would you take the most parsimonious theory to account for what we see?
Yeah.
I think it's important when someone brings this up to say, okay, but we have to remember Christian belief is actually accounting for things that we all agree upon about the world, that we observe in the world. And so if you're rejecting Christianity because it is a very grandiose and elaborate vision of the human person and the universe and our role in it, if you reject it on those grounds, you have to then provide me with a more parsimonious,
right,
less complex accounting for all the things that Christianity accounts for.
Yeah, that's a good way to proceed. And you could say there's nothing simpler than than an account of reality with one first principle that's absolutely simple and accounts for everything else. What would be simpler than that? Certainly, atomism's not simpler if you posit all these atoms. So there's also different kinds of simplicity. There's ontological simplicity, simplicity in terms of laws or axioms, so there's principle simplicity. So that gets tricky in terms of kinds of simplicity. Yeah, that's one thing I'd say. Yeah.
Please do one more thing. And I don't know if this is the right response, but I have used this and turned it back onto a ritual thinking clause on their part, in the sense of I say things like, okay, so let's presume that you became convinced 99% that Christianity is real, but that 1% with you refused on that ground, basically. Then I say something like, but if you were 50% or even 30% sure that on the other side of campus there was a $10,000 giveaway, you'd walk over there in a heartbeat, and you knew there was very likely that wasn't the case, you'd still do it because it would be beneficial to you in this sense. You would stand to gain a lot. So then I sort of say, are you, depending on who I'm talking with or whatnot, I sometimes say, are you making an evidentialist claim? Is it secretly kind of a disguised wishful thinking claim in the sense that you don't want this to be true because we're worried about the implications that
we're having in life? To tell you the truth, Aquinas says exactly that about the Pharisees in the commentary on John. He says that a person can request evidence for two different reasons, morally speaking. You can request evidence in order to verify the truth, or you can request evidence in order to avoid it. And he says the Pharisees are requesting evidence precisely in order to avoid the truth. So what you're getting at is a person is maybe this person is asking for reasons precisely in order to avoid it. So Aquinas has that distinction. When I came across that, I was like, wow, it's there. Yeah.
I find you talking about the faith as testimony, I don't think I've really encountered it, thinking it in that way. And what I was thinking before you were starting to talk about that is, particularly among our generation and the way the world has, like,
yep.
just the way data is, and, like, us growing up with the internet is very different than all past humanity.
Yep.
And, like, there's so much lack of trust in testimony
yep.
that, like, you could start making any claim about talking about any sort of miracle and whatever sort of proof, and it's all relying on testimony.
Right.
But I think among our generation, there is a huge, huge lack of...
That might be the case, but there might be a habit there or a custom of mine.
But then as you started talking about
yeah, like every time
that we naturally take on testimony.
Totally.
Yeah.
If you think about it, it's scary. Like, you get on an airplane, right? And so, like, all these people have testified and said, you're going to fly, like, you know, a mile up in the sky or more, and it's going to be going 600 miles an hour, but everything's okay. Trust us. You know? Or brain surgery. What is brain surgery? I'm going to take this I'm going to cut open your skull, and I'm going to take this knife and stick it in your brain. You'll be okay. Trust me. Trust me. But people do brain surgery every day.
But as soon as you get into, like, a miracle or the reliability of scripture and stuff, it's just like, oh, no.
Right. That's right. So a lot of people have pointed this out, that there's a kind of, what happens is they're inadvertently, out of their will, raising the evidential standard, often without realizing it.
So the best way to kind of combat that?
I think I don't know about trying to combat it. I think what helped me a lot was realizing there are stages of conversion,
yeah.
And people generally have everyone has, like, what we might call a fixed kind of paradigm. Like, there's a certain set of a way of understanding reality, and a certain set of goals and a set of means you're going to use to get to that goal. And as long as a person has their paradigm, other views are, like, just not live options for them. They're just not a live option, to use William James's expression. So, like, I take it that for you, becoming, like, a Buddhist, it's just, or a Hindu, it's just not a live option. And if a Hindu were to come up to you and start trying to give you all these arguments to be a Hindu, it just wouldn't even, like, faze you. Generally speaking, people need to be disposed to hear the arguments for it. And so they're often... they'll talk about there needs to be paradigm breakdown first. Or a person's received paradigm first falls apart. Right? Like the prodigal son wakes up in the pig pen and says, this ain't working. And then they say, I'm going to go try and find something different. And then if a person's looking for something different, and you come to meet them and say, here's testimony and here's confirmatory signs, they're much more disposed to actually listen. So when you're meeting a person... and where they are in their existential journey makes a difference.
Yeah.
But if you want to try to come up with, I'm going to find a way to force feed, it generally doesn't work.
It seems that, because like you said, people take things on faith all the time without really realizing it.
Yeah.
It seems to me that it's not so much faith, but more faith in the supernatural that
right.
people reject.
Good distinction.
And it's interesting because, you know, I see that even in, you know, some Christian churches, like, people will try and come up with naturalistic explanations
yep.
for miracles in the gospel.
Yeah, of course.
And
yeah.
say, well, you know, that was actually because this and this and this happened. And
the very distinction that you're discussing, Augustine and Aquinas are both aware of, and they have the categories of human testimony versus divine testimony, or what you're calling supernatural testimony. And they realize that what is it that actually overcomes the resistance, if you could call it that, to the testimony of God has got to be that inward instigation of the Spirit. So Aquinas has, in the Treatise on Faith, this scenario. There's two different people can listen to the same preacher. One just said, that was ridiculous. And another is like, whoa, I'm going to become a Christian. So what is it that accounts for that difference? It has to be something subjective, something internal to the subject. So the way to think about evangelization, properly speaking, not just apologetics, but like helping people in the conversion process, is to think of yourself as collaborating with the Spirit at work in the person you're talking to. And that collaboration can be a short-term thing. It can be a very long-term thing. So Augustine's conversion process, for example, is stretched out over more than a decade. But different people factored into that in different ways at different times. So it's been said that relationships actually are the best context for these kinds of things. It's when you're with friends whom you trust and who trust you, where there's a kind of people's guard is generally down. They're maybe not as defensive. They'll be more just predisposed to listen. But you're right, nothing's going to bring a person to believe in absolute truth, the testimony of absolute truth, except a proportionate principle. And that proportionate principle can only be something interior. Yeah, Patrick.
I think specifically for me, I found it hard to argue with ex-Christians around this. Like specifically people who would say, like, well, you know, I've tried to believe, I've done my best. Perhaps I've even seen signs,
yeah,
or healings or
right,
whatever. But I never felt anything how I had tried.
Yeah.
So it must not be.
I don't know what to say about that except to say that feelings are not truth indicators by themselves.
Right.
That might be one place to start. That might just be one place to start. That's going to require helping a person in a very particular set of circumstances. What was the form of the faith that you were raised with? There's going to be a lot of straw men lurking there.
Yeah.
You got to find out all the straw men and versions of the doctrine and do a lot of untangling of a history there. We should move on to the next objection. We're going to have a Q&A panel later. I put the problem of evil on here because you are going to face the problem of evil in terms of people raising it up against you. It's still probably the most common objection, or one of the most common objections to the rationality of faith. Aquinas himself raises it in his argument, in his article on the existence of God in the Summa Theologiae. Aquinas formulates what is today called the deductive version of the argument. If God existed, there would be no evil in the world. But there is evil in the world, therefore God doesn't exist. Now Aquinas has a simple answer to that he gets from St. Augustine. Sometimes I just call it Augustine's principle, which is God draws good out of every evil. I think you should just take that principle and sit with it. Aquinas realizes if God exists and if evil occurs, it must be that God draws good out of it. Okay? God draws good out of every evil. Now let's stop. We could think about this for a long time. I had a whole 15-week seminar on the problem of evil. You can go on this forever. But when we say God draws good out of every evil, that's without qualifications. It could be, the good that he draws out of it could be visible. It could be invisible. It could be accessible to us or inaccessible to us. It could be in this life. It could be in the next life. It could be any one of those things. Okay? So it's not like God necessarily draws an empirically verifiable good that we can, you know, experience in this life out of it. Not necessarily. It's just that God draws good out of every evil. So somehow, in the end, every evil will have this good drawn from it. Okay? And that's what really, in a sense, sets up for the next one. Because a lot of people realize, okay, that principle by itself might take out the deductive version. Alvin Plantinga is very famous for having provided what has been a very widely received refutation of the deductive version. He says, suppose there's a possible world in which these evils happen, but all kinds of goods come out in such a way that in the end everything is justified. I mean, okay, that's one possible world. Okay, so all it takes is one possible world, and the deductive version falls apart. Okay? But then people will inevitably say, okay, fine. You say if God exists and he draws good out of every evil, it follows that all the evil in the world is justified. It has some good that's drawn from it or will be drawn from it. That just seems very, very, very unlikely. Therefore, it's very, very, very unlikely that God exists. So is this second argument, the inductive version. This was the one that my old professors favored the most. If God existed, every evil would be justified. But probably, there's at least one evil that's not justified. Meaning, can't draw sufficient good out of it. And you've got to be very careful in dealing with this, because people can drop in your lap and say something like, what about the Holocaust? And you can get yourself into the business. Don't walk into this trap. Just don't walk into the trap, right? There's a major trap there where you walk and you say, well, all kinds of good things have come from it. That's a rhetorical loser, okay? So it's better to say, look, human beings are not competent to assess the goods that could potentially be drawn from all the evils in the world. An infinitely wise God, he alone is competent to assess that. So in other words, you and I are not epistemically qualified to assert premise two of this argument. That's the quick answer to the objection. Given the limits of our reason, the comparative field of data, I mean, it's crazy to think we're competent enough to assess that. Okay? That's the response to the... Now, I suppose I could open the floor to the problem of evil. But if we go there, it's just going to be a long time. So maybe we should just keep on rolling to the next ones. Yeah, because we're going to have a panel later. If people really want to bring it up, we can do that.
Yeah, Father James, you have about five minutes.
Okay.
7 minutes.
Okay, so let's just go through the last ones. They are quicker. So far, the ones I've brought up, really, there's a lot of rational interplay there. People are going back with giving and receiving reasons and trying to make sense of the world. But sometimes I get the impression that large numbers of people have given up on using reason in that way to try to make sense of the world. And we've just gotten to a point where there's kind of emoting or other such things that leave it all behind. So a lot of people have more dismissive forms of arguments. We can call it the progress objection. Once upon a time, people did not understand the universe, and they posited gods to explain things. They appealed to their rewards and punishment to control people. But through the advancement of science and understanding, we know better now. In other words, humanity, the myth of progress, we've made all this progress, and now we just know. It's like a religious worldview is false, and basically scientism or something like it is true, just through progress. Now, to me, that's a very large-scale kind of wand waving, you know, magic wand, like, wave the magic wand of progress, or progress in understanding, and now we just know better. There are much more sophisticated and elaborate forms of the argument. The argument from the success of science can be spelled out, you know, premise, premise, premise. And what you're there, I think, to realize what you're up against, this is not just like a syllogism or an argument. This is the assertion of a whole culture over and against another one. It's like the city of man, like in the Augustinians. Here's this world that we've built. It's a world of science, the world of technology, the world of, and we've kind of advanced this through our efforts over the last several hundred years. It's the most sophisticated explanation of reality ever asserted, and basically that's where we're going to take our stand, over and against your religious kind of thinking. So do you see this is really like the tip of a massive iceberg where there's like really one city against like another? That's why we're going to get into that more tomorrow, okay? But we've got to have some kind of quick responses to this. So we'll need to talk about that maybe on the panel. And then lastly, the Christianity is evil objection. And this seems to me maybe the most common, but you tell me. So look at the first sentence. Christianity is blameworthy for blank, insert bad thing here, okay? And by blameworthy, it can mean any one of a number of claims. Christianity or the church is responsible for this. Christianity and the church was a major contributing factor for this. Or at the very least, Christianity existed at a time when this was going on and did not do anything to oppose it, or did not sufficiently oppose it. Therefore, it's blameworthy in this, like, maybe looser sense, but still blameworthy. And then you can insert whatever you want. Anti-Semitism. It's been said, you know, that Christianity has fomented anti-Semitism. Look at all the pogroms down through the ages, etc. The condemnation of scientific inquiry with Galileo. My old professors used to really rail about Giordano Bruno. That was like, he was a go-to figure. The Inquisition, colonialism, and the oppression of peoples is kind of taken as a given that Christianity was just imposed on the Philippines or on Central America, South America, etc., even though the historical facts are otherwise. The slave trade. Very few people, of course, know about the role that Thomists and Dominicans played in the opposition to the slave trade. Bartolome de las Casas and his work with the Spanish Thomists in trying to oppose the slave trade. People don't know about that, but they've gotten in their textbooks growing up that Christianity facilitated and approved the slave trade, etc., etc. AIDS in Africa, that's a big one. The oppression of women and the oppression of LGBTQ, that's just the latest in a long and very ancient argument that goes back at least to the days of the apostles. Okay. All right, so those are the common objections to Christian faith. And are we done? Do we have time for Q&A, or is that it?
We're scheduled to start why don't we go like 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes,
okay,
of Q&A, take a break.
And then we'll come back for the panel and we'll have more Q&A. Okay, let's do it.
Could you just talk about how you would respond to something like, you know, the Inquisition? Or, I mean, there are a couple on here that I wouldn't know how to.
Yeah. Yeah, right. These are hard because you actually have to be up on the topics historically. So the truth is that there's been, in recent decades, a lot of new history and historical studies of the Inquisition. And it turns out that the picture that was painted of the Inquisition throughout the 19th and 20th century, a lot of that stems from Spanish polemics against or just anti-Spanish polemics by other people in other, you know, empires and whatnot, okay? So a lot of historians have done digging, and they've gone looking at the Inquisition, and they've done a lot of revising the whole thing. And it turns out that the Inquisition did not operate in the ways that it stereotypically purported to have operated. There was like rules of evidence, there was defense available to the person, there was all kinds of, it followed procedural principles that were much different than what, the use of torture was not nearly as extensive as was previously thought, the number of executions was not nearly as extensive as previously thought. In other words, it's been a kind of mythic, it was blown up into mythic proportions. And that myth is still in the process of being undone and revised as we get back to actual records and facts. So I would respond to that by saying there's an ongoing project of historical research, but the trend of the last 3 decades has been to see that the Inquisition is not nearly anything at all like what we previously thought it was, and we're still learning more about what it actually was.
Just to comment on that part, the alternative of not having the Inquisition was even more important.
Was what?
The Inquisition was an appellate court.
Yeah.
Normally, places without the Inquisition, the executions were much higher.
Yeah.
The torture was much higher.
Yeah.
So the Inquisition, not only came with the increase of this, so the counterfactual is more interesting. It's not as bad as you think. It's just, it improved things, right? But
yeah. These are exactly the kinds of considerations that are being advanced by in the new historical research.
Something that usually is brought up in regards to the problem of evil, I'm sure you can bring it up in other ways, is the role of free will in the economy of race or whatever. That's about the ways in which, I mean, that's usually the common response I've heard.
right.
to have control over our actions. I think you can make a similar claim almost about any of the Christianity's evil claims. Like, if there were Christians who facilitated the slave trade, like, you know, these were evil acts. And it kind of, it just is a subsect of the problem of evil argument. You get into it, the idea that there have been evil things done. There's evil
sure.
world, and that ultimately even Christians' roles in that not disprove theology or faith. It just shows that their evil actions can still occur. And you'll ask, why is that? I think you just sort of point to the role of free will. I even tie that, I was going to say earlier, into the evidentialist objection, when people seek this, like, I don't know, this Rosetta Stone almost, in which they just hear it and suddenly they just come to the faith, like, it makes almost put that before you. I usually say, like, that 99% proof idea that I made up before, like, that 1% is actually intentionally preserved in my, you know, in my belief, but because that's, like, the free will percent in some ways. That's where you need to still, of your own volition, make that decision and be inspired by the Holy Spirit. So I think the free will can factor into a lot of this conversation.
It could. You're starting to sound a little like Pascal there, but okay, that's fine. God kind of leaving it difficult on purpose. Yeah, that sounds right. I think we've run out of time.
Stop, yeah.
Yeah, okay, we'll come back for more.
Let's thank
Q&A.